Well, one of the great things about criminal justice reform is that everybody loves it when their idea works. One of the challenging things about criminal justice reform is that eventually somebody has to measure whether it actually worked. Well, that's where researchers get involved. Back in 2019, Pennsylvania passed a major package of reforms known as the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, or JRI2 for short. The legislation promised to reduce costs, to improve outcomes, to expand treatment opportunities, and make the correctional system more efficient. Fast forward several years, and it's report card time. Today, we're joined by Matt Kleiman, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing, to discuss two major evaluations required by JRI2. One, examining short sentence parole. The other, examining the state drug treatment program. The legislators made the predictions. The researchers ran the numbers. Today, we'll talk about what we found. Welcome to Pracademically Speaking.
Hello, welcome back to a new episode of Pracademically Speaking. I'm Brett Buckland, Director of Planning Research and Statistics at the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and regular host on the podcast here. And on a previous episode of Pracademically Speaking, we covered what's known as Justice Reinvestment Initiative 2, or JRI2, as we like to refer to it. And today, I'm very pleased to have on the episode Dr. Matt Kleiman, who's the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. And we're going to have a conversation about some of the evaluations that our respective teams have been working on related to JRI2. So, Matt, I'm very pleased to have you on the podcast today. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Brett. It's a real honor to join you. I'm a big fan of the podcast and looking forward to having our conversation about the work that the commission does here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Great. Well, let's jump into it, Matt. One of the things that I like to start out each episode with is hearing about the background of the guests on the episode. So before we jump into the nerdy research stuff, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, your role as the executive director of PCS, and also maybe a bit about what PCS does. I think a lot of people know that the Sentencing Commission does guidelines and they're familiar with that, but you do a lot more than that too. So I know that's a lot to unpack there, but a little bit about your background, your role, and what the Sentencing Commission does.
Sure. So I became the executive director in 2024 and served in this position now for about 2.5 years. But my journey really started in grad school when I was getting my PhD at Michigan State University. And I connected with some faculty who were studying sentencing in Michigan. In fact, they were the developers of the sentencing guidelines in Michigan in the 80s, and I got to work on a number of National Institute of Justice projects with them. And they directed me to work on, in fact, my dissertation was on corrections, spending, and the trade-off potentially between higher ed and corrections during the 80s of all the expansion of prisons. From there, I went to the National Center for State Courts, which is a nonprofit court improvement organization in Williamsburg, Virginia, and worked there for close to 2 decades on court reform initiatives. Probably worked in about 25 different states. Weirdly, never worked in Pennsylvania, but also had the opportunity to work in a couple of international settings, worked in Kosovo, Serbia, Bulgaria, the West Bank, Canada. Wow. And my topics of study there were on court performance and how to use measurement to improve management. And then my primary issue was on something called workload assessment, like resource models, how many judges are needed in the state of Michigan or how many public defenders are needed in the state of Virginia. Moving forward, I moved to Pennsylvania. My wife became a professor at Penn State University, and there was an opportunity to become the deputy director at the Commission on Sentencing. I worked in that capacity, really leading the research unit and the research enterprise of the commission itself for about 5 or 6 years. So my entire career, if I had to summarize it, is sort of providing decision makers with tools, data, and information to make better decisions. So again, I'm really happy to be on the podcast here to talk about that. And the commission itself, it's an interesting thing. We're the Commission on Sentencing. You would think we focus on following conviction leading to sentencing. But given our longstanding reputation here in the Commonwealth, we have projects and initiatives and responsibilities that span from pretrial, from domestic violence pretrial risk assessments, all the way through working with the parole board and developing parole guidelines. So even though we're the Sentencing Commission, we actually have potentially some work also on bail coming up. So from bail to everything in between. So it's quite a remarkable thing, and we have a team of about 20 employees, and we have a really robust research department of five folks.
What I really love is that you're the executive director and you have a research background. The Sentencing Commission has always been known for supporting research, and I know your predecessor, he was very research oriented, but you actually have the credentials and a research background. And that leads into, I guess, the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is one research project, one evaluation related to JRI2. As I mentioned, we had a previous episode about JRI2, just laying out the landscape of what it was and the different components of it. But one part of JRI2 in the legislation was requiring certain programs to be evaluated. And one of those programs is called short sentence parole. And your agency at the Commission on Sentencing was required to do a routine evaluation of short sentence parole. I understand this is your second evaluation that you recently published of the outcomes of short sentence parole. Can you first just explain to the listeners what short sentence parole is? When the original creators of JRI2, what issue were they trying to tackle with short sentence parole? And then we can talk about what the research is showing.
Yeah, and I'll just start by saying I think it's really remarkable. Again, I'm an outsider here now. I'm an insider here in Pennsylvania, that the General Assembly is wise enough to build into the legislation these mandated evaluations. So we think about feedback loops, and we think about proving or showing that these programs are effective and efficient and good use of community funds. I think it's really an amazing thing that they're built in. Now, of course, it means groups like us and the DOC has to do a lot of work
to do
these evaluations, but that's okay. So short sentence parole, as you mentioned, was established by Act 115 of 2019. And the idea was to reduce correctional costs while preserving public safety by focusing on individuals sentenced to state confinement with a minimum sentence. We're in indeterminate state, so you get a minimum and a maximum sentence, so the minimum sentence of 2 years or less. And the idea was typically an individual goes before the parole board and there's an interview and they could be released at their min or they could be denied parole and they could be, you know, continue that cycle until they're granted parole or they max out. So this was removing for a nonviolent low-risk population who was sentenced to state confinement, removing some of that administrative barriers and releasing them administratively at the min, reducing the workload of the parole board, again, with the idea of reducing costs but not, and while preserving public safety.
Yeah, so some people might call it presumptive parole. Other jurisdictions have things like presumptive parole. But I remember from the JRI2 deliberations, it was, I think, on average, a case that's paroled at its minimum spends about 2 or 3 extra months for a variety of reasons. Often it's because they have to complete some treatment programming, and there's waiting lists at the Department of Corrections to get into programs, and not everybody gets in a program in time to finish it, which thus delays their release, even if the parole board is saying, yes, this is a good candidate for release, but we want you to finish this program. And so this kind of makes the presumption that if they are, you know, if they're doing everything that they're supposed to and the board says they're a good candidate for parole, then they kind of get out automatically at their min date,
yeah,
right?
And that's right. And I just want to highlight that there are some restrictions, of course, and you can't have a crime of violence, no Chapter 61 gun crimes. There's a whole list of restrictions to really pinpoint these lower risk individuals. The parole board also has the discretion to deny individuals to be part of short sentence parole. So not everyone eligible actually makes it into short sentence parole. But we want to focus in our evaluation on that population as well as meaningful comparison groups.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my next question, which is, tell us about the findings of your recent evaluation and what are you seeing with short sentence parole?
Yeah, so I'll just go back to what you mentioned, that we did an initial evaluation in 2023. And since the program really started in 2020, we didn't have enough data to do what we think the gold standard of recidivism analysis of three-year tracking periods. We used a recidivism definition of new arrests then. We just, you know, we were mandated to do it, but we also wanted to get a look at how the program was working. So the great thing of this evaluation that was completed in December 2025 is we had a long tracking period, and we were able to really look at the effectiveness of the program. So we looked at individuals who were in short sentence parole, essentially from December 2019 through May 2025. And just a couple stats. There's about 1,000 individuals eligible per year out of the 10,000 or so new admissions per year. And about 750 to 800 are released under this short sentence program per year. So we had the opportunity to conduct what I think was a really comprehensive evaluation that did a process evaluation, really laid out how this differs from traditional parole. We did an outcome evaluation focused on recidivism, and then benefit cost analysis focused on the cost part. So a couple things that we found was, while in DOC, these individuals committed fewer misconducts, both regular and serious misconducts compared to other comparison groups. There seemed to be an incentive for them, because these misconducts would make them ineligible for being in the program, for them to behave well while in the Department of Corrections. They also completed their mandatory programming at a higher rate. And then as far as recidivism goes, it was interesting that this group, there was no actual programming for them, no intervention, so we don't see a difference in recidivism rates compared to other groups, about 25% within 3 years. But because of this idea of lower risk, we see fewer violent crimes and serious crimes for these individuals when they recidivate, and there's a higher proportion of their new offenses when they recidivate being misdemeanors than the comparison groups. And so just on the recidivism really quick, we used this time a new arrest within 3 years leading to a conviction, which is a much stronger definition of recidivism than we used in the previous evaluation, which just looked at arrests. But the primary benefit is the reduction in confinement time and the early or reentry into the community. So just a couple things there. As you mentioned, the median days from the minimum sentencing date to the release date for short sentence parole compared to the comparison groups is about 106 days less. So that's your cost savings, as you mentioned.
So over three months.
Just right around there.
Yeah.
And over a year, when we annualize that for the 750, 800 people released under short sentence per year, it leads to a bed days per year of 75,000 saved. So using marginal costs, we get a cost savings of about $3.5 million a year from short sentence parole. We also get an unmeasured additional benefit of reduced workload for the parole board. Now, there is a slight increase for parole because these individuals for that 106 days would be under supervision.
They're on supervision
by
longer.
The parole board, but yeah. It's a pretty minimalish cost.
Yeah.
So we found about a net benefit of about $2.5 million.
The cost on parole supervision is like 1/10 of the cost of a day incarceration generally.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So overall, we concluded in this evaluation that the program is working as intended, that we're reducing correctional costs associated with incarceration while preserving public safety. So to me, this is a wonderful illustration of identifying lower risk people. And in this case, you know, the judicial sentence is to confinement in a state facility, but they're lower risk in terms of the general population for the types of crimes they commit, not creating more risk to public safety, while again, we can see this tremendous cost savings that then at the root of justice reinvestment can be used in other ways.
So that sounds like on the whole, it's working out as the founders of JRI2 kind of intended it. That's good to hear. We need to take a quick break, and we're going to look at another program after the break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Pracademically Speaking, a production of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Please share or cite any of the guests or content you hear on this podcast, but do not alter the audio in any way. Check for resources or publications mentioned in this episode in the show notes. Now, back to the host.
We're back here at the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing headquarters at the Capitol Building in Harrisburg, and we're speaking with Executive Director Matt Kleiman about recent evaluations related to Pennsylvania's JRI2 initiative. And Matt, as you know, SSP was only one component of the JRI2 legislative package. There were several other components of JRI2, but one other major component was to expand a program that was formerly known as State Intermediate Punishment, or SIP. And the program was renamed, because that's what we do, we have to rename programs. So the program was renamed to the State Drug Treatment Program, or SDTP. That's the other thing, we love our acronyms. And the SDTP, or State Drug Treatment Program, component of JRI2 also came with an evaluation requirement. For us, it's every 3 years. We're just now at the point where we just finished our first evaluation of that, because we have enough data, we can get into what the program looks like and why that is that we're just now able to do our first report. But anyways, I want to turn the tables a little bit now and have you put on your podcast host hat and ask me a little bit about SDTP and what we found in our evaluation.
Great. Thanks, Brad. And as I mentioned at the beginning, one of the interesting things to me about the legislature is these requirements for the evaluation. And the commission and the DOC had a long history of every other year, I think, doing the evaluations of the former program, SIP. So a lot was known about that. And so why don't you just tell us a little bit about some of the differences that came along with changing it to the SDT program. I know there's some differences in eligibility and how the determination is made who's in the program.
Yeah, the core of the treatment program still works pretty much the same. And I should mention, too, when we were doing that every other year evaluation of SIP, the old program, we did find good results, which is why the General Assembly and the creators of JRI2 wanted to expand this program. But one of the problems was under the old SIP program, it was an opt-in. And so the courts, the judge, the district attorney, had to recommend someone to the department to be in SIP. And a lot of counties had relatively low referral rates, we found, even though this was a evidence-based program, a program that was showing good results. And so we had fairly low referral rates to the program. And so what JRI2 did was switch that around to an opt-out. And so unless the court says no, we don't want this person to be considered for SDTP, then the Department of Corrections at our discretion can put someone in into the program. And so it's the basic change is changing from an opt into the program by the county and the court to an opt out. And that's expanded program eligibility for the program.
Super. And I'm showing my limited experience as a podcast host, because I probably should have asked you to describe and tell us a little bit about the program before I talked about the elements of the program. So tell us about the program.
So again, the core of the program hasn't changed. It's a two-year flat program. You mentioned in the first segment that we're an indeterminate state, so most of our sentences receive an indeterminate sentence where they get a minimum and a maximum sentence. This is a little bit different. It's a flat two-year program. And so they have a two-year sentence in the program, and it's broken into four phases. The first phase is a short stay in the Department of Corrections in a state correctional institution in prison, and they do intensive inpatient treatment in that first phase. Second phase, they move out to a community correction center, often referred to as a halfway house, and they do inpatient treatment for about 3 months, intensive inpatient treatment. And then phase three and four are more about reentry and reintegration. So they can actually go and live at an approved home plan in phase three. They're still doing outpatient treatment. And then phase four is just about reintegration. And so that's the duration of the 2-year program.
What would be the typical number of people in the program in a year?
Before, under the SIP program, before the expansion, we had about 700 people per year coming into SIP. Now, just to give a frame of reference, that's expanded to about 919 individuals per year. So it's a pretty substantial, I think, 31% increase in the annual admissions to the program now under SDTP.
So can you talk a little bit about what outcomes you're looking at to evaluate this and what you found from your evaluation?
Sure. As with your SSP report, one of the main outcomes of interest to everybody is recidivism. So I would say that's the main thing that we focused on in this report. We did not focus on or did not have data on drug relapse. But because this is, and I probably actually failed to say that too, this is primarily a drug treatment program. I did fail to say that. And so that's an important outcome we were not able to look at in this evaluation, but certainly want to look at in future evaluations whether drug relapse rates are going down. But primarily for this evaluation, we looked at recidivism rates and cost, return on investment, again, as with your SSP report. I can jump into the results.
Yeah,
if
please.
You want. Yeah. So as once again with the SSP report, what we found is we looked at rearrest, reincarceration, and that could be for any reason, reincarcerated to the Department of Corrections. And then we have a measure called overall recidivism, which is just either rearrest or reincarceration. And we found that for, and again, we did a matched comparison group, a group that looked very similar but just did not receive SDTP. We found that there was no significant difference in recidivism rates for SDTP except for reincarceration. And the reason why I think it makes sense is because SDTP cases, when they finish that flat 2 years, are not under parole supervision. Whereas the comparison group are under parole supervision. And what that means is that they're susceptible to being returned for what we call technical parole violations, not being where they're supposed to be at the right time, absconding, further drug use, things like that. They can be returned for those. SDTP completers cannot be, because they're not supervised, cannot be returned for something like that. So their only pathway back is being rearrested. And so it makes sense that reincarceration rates are lower for SDTP, significantly lower. But overall recidivism and rearrest was not significantly lower. But the cost savings was appreciable. So what we estimated was for every SDTP graduate, we're saving about $63,959. And when you multiply that by the number of graduates that have now been through the program, we estimate that we've saved about $140.8 million.
And where do the savings come from?
Primarily from that shorter stay in a DOC facility, a prison. So they're spending 9 to 10 months inside compared to the comparison group, which are spending a substantial longer period of time incarcerated. Some of the savings do come on the back end too with less returns for parole violations, that's that reincarceration thing. So we don't get the technical violators back. But the main one is just the shorter period of incarceration.
Great. So I think I'm going to give you back the hat for leading this podcast.
Hey, we're just having a conversation here. But yeah, in wrapping up, I think, well, first of all, I'd be interested to ask you if you see any commonalities between your SSP report and my SDTP report and what your thoughts are on that and what we've learned respectively from those two reports.
Yeah, I think what we're finding is that these JRI2 programs are very effective, and they're effective in reducing costs, but also preserving public safety. And I think that one of the questions, like from a larger evaluation, rather than thinking about these independently, would be to think about how people are being filtered into the various programs through some priority, and would someone do better in a different program or worse in a different program, and how that assignment or eligibility, there's a lot of overlap between these programs. That would be a really challenging project to do, but it might be interesting to think about even just the right classification to the people to the right programs, be it RRRI or SSP or boot camp, et cetera. So, but that's a much bigger enterprise than I think either of us want to tackle.
Yeah, well, we'll need some further resources to do that, but it would be a fun challenge to work together and look at the comparative return on investments of these different programs for specific subpopulations and kind of figure out who's better to go to SSP versus who's better to go to STTP. We're trying to make that best evaluation right now, but from a quantitative evaluation data standpoint, who would be the better fit for those various programs? And that's an exciting thing. And I agree with you, too. My read is that this, both of our research is showing that it's working as intended. It's not hurting public safety, even if it's not reducing appreciably recidivism, but it is saving. And so there's no public safety harm, and it's saving significant tax dollars. So I think that's a win for both of these programs.
Yeah. As I was thinking about the short sentence parole a little bit, and obviously there's no specific risk assessment tool, but I was just reminded of a program in Virginia where, because of overcrowding, and this would have been early 2000s, I think, they developed a tool to identify nonviolent offenders who were sentenced to prison to divert them to something else. And they wanted to divert 25% of these individuals who would have gone to prison to something else without jeopardizing public safety. And so they were able to use risk assessment, which we'll save for another time to talk about the merits of that.
Yeah.
But I think that this is a similar idea of using smart practices to, again, limit the exposure and limit the time when it's not necessary and remove some of the administrative barriers and, of course, have cost savings associated with it.
Yep. Well, as we're wrapping up here, any last word in terms of the future, where you think this kind of work is going?
Yeah, I think one of the great things here in Pennsylvania that I'm really proud of is the relationship that the commission has with its partner agencies, be it the Department of Corrections, the Administrative Office of the Courts, Pennsylvania State Police, PCCD, and others. We share data willingly. We cooperate. We have discussions about this. We're all in this together to improve the Commonwealth and preserve public safety and be thinking about the best programs as well for individuals who have substance involvement, mental health issues. So a couple things that I'll just note that I think that the commission's really interested in is we would like to expand our evaluations in this space to include specific costs of crimes. So I mentioned for SSP that the types of crimes they're committing when they're recidivate are of different nature. So we have violent crimes, serious crimes being less. So can we monetize those and build those into our model as cost savings? Secondly, we're working hard right now with different agencies and groups to be thinking about getting behavioral health data. So as you mentioned, we looked at our outcome as recidivism, and that's a traditional criminal justice approach. And we would like to expand that to these behavioral health outcomes. So do these programs impact housing, employment, drug relapse rates, what some people might call the social determinant of health? This is a challenge where systems are not speaking to one another. Some of these data are at the county level, not at the state level. The usual challenges we face as researchers all the time. But we're trying to find active solutions to not just talk about doing this, to actually do it in the future. And I'm optimistic that we'll be able to, maybe through some pilots with some specific counties like Allegheny. But that's the great hope, is not just to focus on, especially when we know that a lot of these individuals have challenges. We just got a mandate to do some work that we just completed looking at veterans involved in the criminal justice system and the unique challenges they have related to PTSD, PTSI, et cetera. And what resources are available for them. And it's not just involvement with continued involvement with the criminal justice system. It's these other factors of employment and so forth, stability factors.
Well, you definitely have your work cut out for you. You're no shortage of work. And the commission has always done great work in research. And I really appreciate all the work that you're doing at PCS. We're out of time, but Matt, thanks for discussing with me JRI 2 and SSP and SDTP. And hopefully we'll have you back on to hear about some of these other initiatives that you're working on in the future. So thanks for the collaboration as well.
Great. And we look forward to working with you and your team and trying to just keep improving things in the Commonwealth. So thank you.
Thanks for listening. Check out Pracademically Speaking wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. This is the conversation where ideas and numbers get real, on the ground and in practice. Pracademically Speaking is a production of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections.